Welcome to this edition of the MDM podcast. My name is Tom Gale, CEO of Modern Distribution Management. In our coverage of M&A activity across every distribution sector for MDM over the past 30 years, we've analyzed many case studies of deals gone bad or where expectations for value creation fell far short. There are plenty of examples. Often the downfall is some combination of culture clash, communication breakdown, or lack of planning for managing the inevitable disruption and changes that take place in any deal. Our conversation today will touch on the people side of mergers and acquisitions. We'll take a deeper look at the critical elements of change management, communication, and culture that have become even more complex in hybrid workplace environments over the past 3 years. My guest today is Jennifer Fondreve, the founder of Day One Ready, a consultancy that advises business leaders on how to prepare for the human capital challenges of M&A. She's been on all sides of the deal equation. She's written a book on managing the people side of M&A, as well as articles for leading business publications, which we'll touch on later. Jennifer is the keynote speaker for our 2023 Virtual Distribution M&A Summit, February 22nd and 23rd. We'll be covering a lot of ground to deepen your knowledge base on the current landscape of distribution M&A, including how to best position your company for sale and valuation, ESOPs as an alternate exit strategy, M&A as a growth strategy for you, and much more. I highly recommend that you tap into the most experienced dealmakers and advisors in distribution that we're bringing together for this summit. You can view the full agenda at mdm.com. Jennifer, I'm delighted to speak with you today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really looking forward to your kicking off our upcoming M&A summit, and I'll come back to that later. But first, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you come to your current work in M&A advisory?
I really, frankly, stumbled into it. I'm a marketing advertising executive, went to graduate school. Everything that I had prepared for was always around marketing and communications. Yet in that capacity as a marketing executive, I went through three separate multi-billion dollar acquisitions. Merger and acquisitions had not been a part of my career up until that point. But I would say by the third acquisition experience, I thought there had to be a better way to do M&A, where the value, what had been seen as the greatest opportunity, was actually fulfilled. Because in my experience, there were a lot of things that didn't go right that could have, with better planning around the people piece, around how people react to change and navigate and manage that. And so that's what set me on my current path. As you noted, I wrote a survivor's handbook. I've been told that the choice of word survivor is an interesting one. But, you know, for me, I wanted to be upfront about the emotional experience and then how to set up business owners, CEOs, and leaders for how to be more successful through that time.
Yeah. So there are, of course, two sides to every M&A deal. And so I'd like your thoughts on how to craft a playbook for a successful deal from each side of the table. I've got a couple of scenarios for you. So I'm an owner, or I'm leading a second or third generation family business, and I've decided that I want to think about selling, maybe to competitors, maybe somebody else in the market who's looking to grow. How do I best help my team in this process? What does my playbook look like for making sure that my team gets to a good place in this process?
Well, first, I should say, Tom, I've been on all sides. I've been acquirer and acquiree. And it was actually thanks to that perspective that I realized there are commonalities, you know, what both sides experience, because both sides need each other to succeed. That is sometimes lost in the narrative around mergers and acquisitions, but both sides need each other. And for me, that is a critical piece of what leads to success, that both sides come to this partnership with respect for the other side, with respect for what that company brings to the union. So first and foremost, I always highlight that regardless of what side you're on, that respect has to be there and has to be evident and felt. One of the things that I find interesting and where I really spend a lot of time with CEOs and business owners is, the sooner you can involve your leadership and your next level down, meaning those people who are really the frontline leaders, people who are making things happen, the more you can involve them in not necessarily the decision-making process, but making them aware of this is what we're pursuing, here's how we're looking at it, and getting their input for what it will take, what are the resources, the timing. It's those leaders who do that level of buy-in upfront where I've seen the greatest success. I'm always reticent to call it a playbook because while my book found the commonalities and the themes, and we'll talk about that in a minute, each deal is unique. I talked to many CEOs who had done a variety of M&A deals, and they shared one of their greatest lessons learned is they had a playbook, but each deal is unique. And you need to go in with eyes wide open that they're unique because people are unique. You're going to have a different set of players in one company that will influence how the deal goes. So absolutely, we'll talk about playbook and the things you need to be aware of. But the other key takeaway I would say is you need to appreciate that people are what make your company, and they are what will make the deal successful or not. And the more you can get their buy-in and involvement, the better off you're setting yourself for success.
So is there a rule of thumb for timing to bring in that leadership and start to have that conversation?
My ingoing advice always is don't wait till you announce. The opportunity is in that due diligence. Now, obviously, from a legal and confidentiality standpoint, and you can do that, right? You can set it up where you sign people on, you have binding agreements, but the more you can involve your frontline leaders into the deal discussion and how you're looking at it, the better success you will have. In my book, I share some stories about the time where leaders did do that and found out that an entire department, that in the discussions, they were thinking, well, we don't need them. But the frontline leader said, if you let those guys go, no one will know how to run the equipment. Like they are integral to how we succeed. And you may not think of them as important because, you know, they're several layers down. But the time it would take us to train new people, particularly during an integration, right, where you've got a lot of moving parts, will really delay our ability to get certain products out. So I just use that one story as an example of the more you can involve your frontline leaders who know what it takes to get the job done. It would be the equivalent, I think, is if you had a general do a war strategy without having talked to the front line. You've got to really be smart on what it will take to execute, and for me, that due diligence period is your opportunity to do that.
So let's talk a little bit about post deal when it's executed. What's the right strategy for communicating, announcing, and then making sure that the rest of the team is really going to be in a positive place or as positive as possible going forward?
I think one of the mistakes that I see, and I'm even hesitant to call it a mistake because I think the ingoing desire is the right one. There's often a sense of communicating nothing's changed, right? We're gonna keep doing the great things that we've always been doing. But the reality is things have already changed just by nature of the fact that you've gone into a partnership with another company, whether it's a merger or an acquisition. And when you say nothing has changed, your workforce, what they hear is, well, this person isn't going to be upfront about anything because everything's already changed. How I'm going to do my job is in question. I'm not even sure I'll still have a job. The reality of the situation is, unfortunately, mergers and acquisition, just the words alone come with a lot of negative baggage. People have either had friends who have gone through it, maybe they've gone through it before themselves, or they've read about a merger and acquisition in the news. And you and I both know the news never highlights the positive things that happen. So people already have built up thinking around here's what's going to happen. So you never want to set it up by saying nothing's going to change. Where I've seen leaders be most successful is when they paint a picture that is a vision of here's what this deal means for us. And they acknowledge the value that both companies are bringing to the partnership. I mentioned that before, coming to that partnership with respect, but then articulating that, sharing a vision for where the company is going and how this partnership is going to succeed because of what both parties bring to that. So first and foremost, during that due diligence, craft what that vision is. Be clear on what that vision is. It helps people when you announce not only that the deal is happening, but what that deal will bring. It allows people to more quickly understand the role that they can play, how they might contribute to that vision. The other thing that I would highlight is it is not just the role of marketing and the human resource department to figure those things out. Often, if a company hasn't been crafting that communication plan during that due diligence, you know, they make the announcement, the focus is on the announcement, the communication of that, but then they delay the communications for everything else because they think everything's just focused on the announcement, when really you need to bring in your HR and marketing partners to make sure you're crafting not only the vision, but the cascade of communications. And this will vary obviously on size of company, but if you go in with, that's where I would have the playbook, right? What you're going to communicate, the vision, the talking points, and then also having as many answers to questions as you can on that day one. It's why I call my company Day One Ready. For me, being Day One Ready is you've already thought of all these things and have started to plan for them before you make that announcement.
Yeah, that's interesting. The examples that came to mind while you were talking of failures over the last 2 or 3 decades that we've been covering M&A and distribution has happened when a large company has come in and acquired a smaller, whether it's a one branch or it may be multi-branch, but a lot of the value creation that local distributor has built is out with the relationships with the customers. And they've been often very flexible and, you know, very customer focused, customer centric in terms of, hey, yeah, we can do that for you. And then a larger entity will come in and start to change a lot or put in policy rules in that. And there's been a lot of examples that customers have said, hey, you know, I'm going to go find somebody else who can be a little bit more flexible and do business the way I want to and not how you're starting to tell me how to do it.
Yeah. You know, and I'm so glad you brought that up because I've seen that example happen repeatedly as well. It's why, Tom, even in one of our discussions, I talk about when you're not only just in the due diligence, but as you're doing that integration, you need to work back from what is best for the customer. Ideally, what's guiding that is you're already thinking about that in terms of the deal, right? Will this be a solution that really helps us better deliver for our customer? If you're thinking that the solution is purely based on, well, here, what are the products that we offer? And that's how now we're going to be able to offer a portfolio of products, right? I've seen this happen time and again, where companies do that M&A deal because now we have a suite of products and solutions to offer. But they forget in that equation that when you've had a really great customer relationship, part of that is because you've built a relationship exactly as you describe. So you need to be cognizant of that in the deal time discussion as well, not just the solutions that we're offering, but what was our relationship based on? And then how do we continue to deliver on that as well as the offering? In fact, actually, I'm working on an HBR article around that very thing right now, because I've seen it happen so many times where the relationship is severely damaged because now there are delays in getting products. They don't know who to talk to. That hasn't been thought through or worked out in advance.
I want to talk a little bit more about deal structure, but first, let's go to the other side of the table. What's your advice to acquirers, whether they be strategic or financial? And you tell me if there's a difference, really. But what's the advice for making sure that the integration is going to be as positive as possible, that team members can process what's taking place and get on board with a lot of very inevitable change and disruption?
Well, one of the things, and it's probably why I get labeled by CEOs as an M&A whisperer, because one of the things I'll always say to CEOs is you need to look at this as it's an onboarding event. You are onboarding an entire workforce, whether it's 10 people, 100 people, it's an onboarding event, and you need to think of it that way. We all can fall into the situation where we're so excited about something, we assume everyone will have the same level of excitement. And CEOs, particularly if they have been thinking about this deal for a while, they've gone through the due diligence, they see the opportunities, they're already 8 months ahead in terms of how they've envisioned where they're already going to be. You need to allow people to have the time to get to that point as well. It's why oftentimes I'll talk about the stages of grief. People now suddenly are realizing that the future that they had envisioned for themselves is going to change, and they're not sure what it's changing into. And again, unfortunately, they tend to think of the worst case scenarios. It's going to change, but maybe not for the better. So when CEOs anticipate, I need to give people time to catch up, to be as excited about this as I am, and then treat this as an onboarding event. You know, and I will absolutely share that I am biased. I was a former marketing executive, and I have found when you involve your marketing and your HR people so they can help you make sure you're thinking holistically about how we not only communicate this, but get people onboarded. The other thing particularly drives my reason for doing this during due diligence is what you expect in that year one, if you haven't allowed time for people to adapt and pivot and understand not only the vision, but the role that they play, you need to allow that time. The valuation exercises that I've seen where it doesn't go well is they haven't allowed time for people to do that adjustment, to go through those integration challenges. Everyone experiences them. You need to allow time for that. You know, this is not to delay and coddle people, but at the same time to give them the breathing room and in my case, you know, the tools and techniques to do that pivot, to make that shift. The more you see that as an onboarding event where you need to be a different type of leader to help people get on board, oftentimes just that mindset shift for CEOs and leaders is enormously helpful because they take the time to back up and say, okay, I've got to give my people the time to get to where I am already.
Let's dive a little deeper into deal structure from a human capital aspect. We talked before about the Harvard Business Review article that you wrote in 2018 that I think then kind of propelled you to write the book. That the title of that article was After a Merger, Don't Let Us Versus Them Thinking Ruin the Company. And in that, you identify three key actions to minimize the downside potential. And so I'd like to just briefly touch on those. And I know in your keynote, you're going to be diving in a little bit deeper on all of these things. But the first is a well-planned integration with a cohesive culture as the focus. What does that look like?
Absolutely. One thing though, Tom, that I do want to add just in relation to your earlier comment about it's what propelled the book. It propelled, frankly, the business that I do now. The reaction to that article revealed to me that there was an interest in what about the people component of mergers and acquisitions, the emotional part, the part that typically doesn't get talked about a lot in articles or books. And it was in interviewing executives. I was interviewing them to see if there was ever, if there would be interest in a book. And that's where this article came from, because so many CEOs said, everyone talks about the us versus them, our company versus their company. But they don't always appreciate that there are other dynamics, our company versus their company, executives versus frontline leaders, and who stays versus who goes. And it was those three dynamics that came forth in the interviews that I did that had me write that article and see that there was interest in, well, okay, so how do we deal with these dynamics? Your question about the first one, right? A well-planned integration, what does that look like? For me, and that's a big part of the work that I do, is helping leadership on both sides of the partnership see the other side. Oftentimes, there's an assumption of, you know, we've had dinner together, the leadership, we've gone out, we've enjoyed steak, we've had great wine. I really like these people, that can work. But culture goes so much deeper. than that. The exercise that I'll often do with leadership alignment sessions that I do is helping them think like a tourist. It's one of the reasons why, you know, international business was my area of expertise before, but the same lessons apply. When you think like a tourist and you're going to another country, right? It's a culture that you're trying to get familiar with. And I bring that to the corporate world. How do I think like that? So we're really appreciating one another's culture and what both will bring, right? Not one company imposing its culture on another, but how does the culture of my company gel well with yours? What are the things that work well? Where are the differences actually that bring out the best in each other? If you think of like a marriage, right? You oftentimes will see some great partnerships because both sides bring out the best in each other. They're very different, but they bring out the best. And that's what I'm always trying to do with leaders as well. Help them bring the best out in each other. So you don't have to have cultures that are completely aligned, but how, when there are differences, do you bring the best out in each other?
Yeah. The second key action that you identify in that article is consistent communication and commitment to the transition in both words and action. And why do you frame it that way?
It actually was, there was one example. I've had leaders share with me their mistakes. They didn't necessarily achieve the success they hoped they had in getting people excited about the deal. And what was reinforced repeatedly, CEOs, CTOs, business owners, and leaders was when I said something, right? I said, hey, this is exciting. We need to do everything we can to make this integration happen. But if my actions didn't necessarily demonstrate that, if I wasn't quick in my decision-making, if I was delaying because I didn't know enough, or I felt that I needed to delay a decision, it what people interpreted was, oh, he or she isn't excited about this. He or she doesn't believe in the vision. They have hesitance. And the CEOs in particular said, I didn't realize my every word and deed, everything I did was going to be analyzed. You know, are you really behind this or not? And so it was through their stories that they revealed to me that I really wanted to emphasize in the article. It's not just what you say, but it's what you do and how you do it.
It's walking the walk.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the third key action you mentioned is an organizational structure defined by what's best for the customer. You touched on that before, but talk a little bit more about that.
So one of the stories that I share is there were two companies, and actually this was a merger, an acquisition that I went through, but it was the product leader who shared this story with me. He said they were at a stalemate with the company. They were doing integration exercises, and both sides felt that how they delivered on the product was the better way of doing it. They were entrenched in their way being the best practice. And he said it was thanks to a junior product manager who piped in and said, what's best for the customer? We're arguing that we have the best way of doing this, but we set out to do this deal to better deliver on our customers' needs. So let's stop fighting about whose way is the best way, but what's best for the customer? Let's work back from that. Is it the timing? You know, getting it to them faster? Is it the actual product itself? Is it wrapping a greater solution around it? Let's stop, you know, arguing about whose way is best, but work back from what their needs are, really dissect that. And then whose approach is better becomes secondary. And I thought it was such a powerful example of working back from what the customer needs.
Final area I wanted to touch on, and I know you're going to be addressing all of the things we've been talking about in a little bit more, I guess, holistic way or a little bit more depth when you give a keynote in February. How has the pandemic and all of the massive changes in the workplace dynamics that have taken place over the last 3 years really shifted things from your perspective in terms of making sure that a successful M&A integration can take place?
There's been a lot of takeaways, but the one that sticks out for me that CEOs have revealed, in the past, there was a little bit of a sense of, with a merger and acquisition, this is the way we do it, you know, get on board or don't. I would say CEOs now have appreciated the importance of the workforce, their employees, their buy-in, the role that they play in the success of the company, and a greater sensitivity to what can I do as a leader to help my workforce, my employees get excited about this? How can I help them to see the vision that I see, as opposed to just dictating, this is the vision, here's how it goes, you're in or you're out? There's a greater desire on the part of CEOs to paint that vision in a way that people get as excited as he or she does. I'd say the other thing, you know, I guess the other part that was apparent before the pandemic, but is just magnified now, is you need to preserve your talent. You need to. You can't afford to lose your key talent. You can't afford to lose that drop in productivity. You know, the time it takes you to find that new person, train them, you don't have that. So in a merger and acquisition, that is amplified. So CEOs not only are sharing a desire to get their employees excited and bought into the vision, but equally recognizing I've got to keep them in order for this to be successful. So what can I do in advance to make sure I do everything possible to keep my key talent? And when I say key talent, I think the CEOs are also recognizing it's not just their leadership. Their key talent can come from anywhere in the organization. And so I'm always helping them to see, make sure you know who really are your key talent. What's the glue? Who are the key players who play that glue, who make your company hum?
Well, you know, that's, and gosh, we could get into this for an hour or two, but the one part I want to just touch on that you just commented about was there's an element to this. It seems that it's an opportunity as you go through this process to really elevate the team from the standpoint of there may be some members on board actually who in this transition, it's pretty appropriate for them to be the ones who are transitioning out. But I've got to believe that that has a very positive opportunity for the rest of the people who remain behind, who probably say, oh, well, finally, you know, Joe is, you know, wish he was gone 5 years ago. But right. you know what? That my future here may actually look brighter than when Joe was my boss.
Yeah, it's one of the key things that I get a lot of questions about from CEOs. And I'll always say, listen, you've always got your rock stars, but remember the metrics for success are now changing. And rock stars, the ones I've seen, can't always pivot quickly, because what made them successful was against a different set of metrics. I said, so don't be surprised, and even allow opportunities for new leaders, new rock stars to emerge, people who you actually may not have even had on your radar, but now because the metrics for success have changed, they can rise to the occasion because it plays to their strengths. So don't just assume, oh, I've got to do everything possible to hold on to this rock star. You'll be aware that this person may struggle a bit, not to say that they will or won't, but just be prepared for that. But equally allow the opportunity for new rock stars to emerge.
The title of your session, of your keynote, but you'll also be moderating a panel with that. And we've got some great panelists for you to work with. But the title of that's going to be the three C's of human capital in M&A, change management, communication, culture. We've talked about all of those things. What's the key takeaway you want people to leave when you're done with that keynote and conversation that we have at the end of February?
It's really how we started off this discussion, Tom. I have found, I guess it's kind of the golden rule in life. Treat others as you would like to be treated. And so when I have talked with CEOs, the golden rule is come to the partnership with respect for the other side. How do you show up? How do they show up? And how do you demonstrate the value that you both bring? But then share that with your employees. They will follow your lead. And I really think that's been consistently when I have seen deals be successful, and thankfully I've been a part of a number of those discussions, it's when both sides are showing that respect because it cascades down.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your time today and insights. I look forward to our time together at the M&A Summit, February 22nd.
I do as well. And thank you again for the invitation. Mm-hmm.